This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho. Now, here is where we talk to knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the programs and resources that try to help them. Today, we're going to try to answer the question on the topic, fascinating topic, building better humans. And it's we're talking about parenting. And want to remind the listeners, on the lower hand right of the screen, there's a chat function. And if you have a question, you can chat on. You can click on that, and then we'll try to get it out and have our guests answer. The guests are David and Lisa DeVoe. They're from Illinois, and they wrote a book, Building Better Humans. But they're writers, speakers, and everyday business owners. They're the parents of three children and have been teaching on marriage and family issues for over 20 years in the U.S. and around the world. Their practical, humorous approach makes their writing enjoyable and their advice unforgettable, and so we're going to get a sample of that here today. Now, Building Better Humans, and let's start. What is the purpose of your book, Building Better Humans? Either one of you.
Yeah, we wrote the book because we find that parents, it's sort of bewildering as a parent to sort of pick and choose what do you do to raise good children. We wanted to make it as simple as possible in terms of some advice, so we laid out 12 parenting principles that will apply pretty much to everyone, and so that's the purpose. It's a relatively short book, 155 pages with 12 principles, so the idea being meant to be very practical for parents to be able to apply and see results right away.
This is sort of unique in books like this because instead of being a professional in that field, you know, a psychologist, educator, something like that, you're basing on your experience of raising three kids. And that gives, to me, a lot of authenticity or credibility.
Thank you. Yeah, we've read, of course, many materials on parenting. We've attended many seminars. We give seminars, and we've been doing that for a long time. And our feeling was a lot of times when you read a psychiatrist's approach to parenting, what you get is an approach based on their view of seeing kids in crisis. And that's very, very helpful, but it sort of leaves this gap of, okay, but what do I do with my kids the rest of the time? Or how do I keep them from getting in crisis in the first place? And so that's what led us to write the book.
Yeah, that prevention is very important because as an independent educational consultant, I work with parents. Kids are in crisis. Some of the stories are hair-raising, and it would have been nice if somebody would have talked to them or they would have learned some of the things that could have avoided this necessity for residential placement. Well, out of the 12 principles, and we can go through all 12 of them if it comes to that, but which one do you think is the most important specifically for the teen years?
Yeah, I think they apply to all years. The most important one would be our principle number two. And basically, it's talking about building or keeping an open line of communication. And the principle is if you want your child to talk to you about the stuff you consider important, you have to listen to what's important to them first.
Oh, that makes sense. Easier said than done sometimes.
Yeah, you know, it's easier to start early. So what it means is when your five-year-old wants to talk about Pokemon, which you absolutely don't care about, then if you listen at that point and show them value, then when they get to their teen years and you wanted them to talk about the person they're dating or how they're doing in school, then they are more likely to talk to you. If when they're talking about Pokemon or Barbies or Legos or whatever, you just say, they're going to pick up really quickly that what they have to say doesn't matter to you. So, I mean, if you start it early, it's much easier, but you can start to apply this even when they're teenagers. And we think that's the key is getting that open communication between you and your child.
Okay, well, everybody knows the stereotypical image of a teen. And it's something like, where are you going? Out. Who are you going to see? Somebody. You know, one word answers. Is it possible? Everybody's gone through some of that, at least. Is it possible to get teens to communicate? Let's kick that one around a little bit.
Yeah, the thing that you have to start with is to get them to communicate about stuff they want to talk about instead of the stuff you want to talk about. So that might be the band that they're interested in. You know, in other words, figure out what their interests are. And get involved in those. So in the case of our youngest son, for instance, he's very interested in chess. I hadn't played chess since I was a young kid. I was never very good at it because I don't think that many moves ahead. He's a state chess champion. I mean, he's really, really good. So I took up chess again just to connect with him so that he could talk to me about moves in some game. And he'd go on for like an hour talking about how he won a particular game. And, you know, normally that would not be something of great interest to me, but by developing it as an interest, it gave me an opening into his life so that each day he would come and talk about games he played. That then allows me to turn around and ask about other things in his life. And that's true whether it's a band they like, a game they play, a sport they play, just basically what's of interest to them.
One of the things that comes out of that is even if the topic isn't particularly interesting to you as a parent, when you show an interest, it shows that, and the kids will probably know that this is not going to be something that you're going to pursue after they're gone, but it shows that topic is important because the child is important to you. So I'm not going to pursue a particular band because my child likes it. But because I like it, but I'll choose it because my child likes it, and it just exemplifies a way of proving that you really care about every aspect of their lives, and that will open up tremendous conversation opportunities.
So I presume that that it's easier to get started with that communication earlier, but you can make up for lost time even later when they're a teen and you try to start it. But that's a little bit more difficult, I would imagine.
That's true.
Yeah, it's more difficult, but you can do it. One of the things that we did at our house is an open communication policy. And we had some struggling teens of one of our relatives. The parents were having trouble. And so they came and lived with us for a while. And so we had to start with teenagers that did not have that expectation. And part of it is we're very intentional. So we just tell them, look, you can ask us about anything. There is no subject that's off limits. Do you want to ask about sex? Do you want to ask about homosexuality? Do you want to ask about drugs? Do you want to ask about getting your ear pierced? Do you want anything you want to ask about? There's no subject you can't ask us. And one of the things we would advise parents is never tell your child, I'll tell you when you're older. Because what if they ask you a question, that shows their interest. And if you say, I'll tell you when you're older, they'll just go get the answer from somewhere else. And the question is, don't you as the parent want to be providing input on any area they're interested in?
You know, I have a question on the chat here. Should you answer all the questions that they start asking you? And it follows up, is there getting too much in the kids and to be so much involved in the kids? So could you respond to that? I think you've halfway answered that, but let's talk about it a little bit more.
Absolutely. If they open up a conversation with a question, absolutely answer that question to the best of your ability. And sometimes the answer may be, this is not an area of my expertise, but let's talk about it and let's maybe research the topic together and figure out what they want to know. One of the tricks that I always used was asking was answering the question with a question, because often they will ask a question with an ulterior motive.
Right.
And the trick is to find what that ulterior motive is. So I always say, why do you ask? What do you think about this? Those kind of questions give a better overall picture of what they're really looking for.
It also depends on their age. So you give an age-appropriate answer. I remember the old story about the child asking his father, a young child asking his father, where do we come from? And the child takes a deep breath and tells him all about the birds and the bees, and then after a pause, the kid says, the Johnsons are from Philadelphia, where do we come from? And it's kind of funny, but it reminds us as a parent, we want to answer every question. We never want to say, I'm not going to answer that. But the answer can be very age appropriate, can be just the information they're looking for, and then let them ask for more information.
That can be a little tricky, but I imagine what you're saying is that you need to really work at tuning into the kid, trying to get into the kid's head what they're really after. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. The other thing is that your answer should always be honest. And I know that sounds obvious, but if you give an inaccurate or a dishonest or deceptive answer to your child, that will come back around and bite you later. They'll realize, wait a minute, you weren't telling me the truth about that. And so, can I really trust you to tell me the truth about other things? And for us, that meant answering true questions about our relationship, about our marriage and so forth when we were talking to the kids, so that they can learn from our mistakes as well and not have to repeat them. And I think sometimes people try and hide, like let's say you have an older child that's struggling with drugs. What some people do is they try and hide that from the younger children. That's never effective. The younger children know something's going on, and by hiding it, you hide the opportunity. You give up the opportunity to speak to them about what's going on in their life and, you know, what your concerns are, and basically you bring them into the discussion, which is what you want. And again, you want to keep it age-appropriate, but the more discussion, the more questions you can get from your kids, the greater that communication is.
Okay. Well, the chat has a question, but doesn't that teach to counter a question with a question instead of an answer? How do you differentiate? Because sometimes I imagine you need to answer, and sometimes a question is a good way to go. So how do you differentiate?
I don't know that we know the answer to that question. Lisa is really good at that. She's much, you know, it's just something that you develop finesse about. Obviously, you don't want to just keep asking a question. That's actually a game we play, that some families play, that you have to answer a question with a question, and the person that actually says a non-question loses. But obviously, at some point, you just ask a couple questions to clarify, and at some point, you have to give information. Our youngest son has some special needs. He gets frustrated if you ask him too many questions. So each child is a little different. But if you ask an initial question of why do you ask, or what do you think, it can help frame the conversation in the right direction. And you can even, if they get frustrated with that, you can just say, I'm just trying to understand. I want to be able to answer your question. I need to understand what exactly you're looking for. So you can't just ask questions, but starting with questions can make a big difference in understanding what they're looking for.
Yeah, and I can see where that can be very important. It calls for a little bit of intuitive or psychic ability or something to see what's going on. The chat person sort of summed it up fairly nice. Make sure you're involved with your kids and have an open relationship with them. Is that a fair assessment?
Very.
Yes, that's a great summary. Being involved with them, I think that some people think you go for that quality time. The problem is quality time happens among quantity time, so you don't get to pick that key moment. For those of us who have older children, our youngest is 19 now. Our kids will come back and they'll tell us some key moment, something we said in their childhood that had a really positive influence on them or a really negative influence on them. And the bad thing as a parent, I didn't get to pick what those sound bites were. So it basically, we have to spend a lot of time with them and develop a relationship, because I'm hoping in the aggregate, they will overlook some of the stupid things I've said and build on the things that were positive.
Yeah, we all cross our fingers on that, that's for sure. Well, let's ask another question, another area. How does disciplining a teen work differently than disciplining younger children? So what's the progression that that you, in your experience, you have to go through in keeping in touch with where the kid's at and, you know, appropriately, like you say?
Well, I listened to some of your old past shows, Lon, and I heard one talking about the same thing we talk about, which I was excited about. We call these parenting principles, and we talk a lot about teaching with rules and not with teaching with principles and not with rules. But the younger a child is, the more you need to rely on rules. Just an example is when your child's really young, you might set a rule: don't touch the stove. That's the rule: don't touch the stove. Because they can't judge whether the stove is hot or cold, so they're just not allowed to touch it. When they get older, that rule becomes don't touch the stove when it's hot. When they get a little older, it's please touch the stove, make brownies, make cookies, whatever. And so when it comes to parenting, it works the same way. You start with the rules as young children, but as quickly as possible, we want to teach them the principle. Let me give you an example with teenagers. What they watch on television or what kind of movies they watch. A lot of parents set a rule. You're not allowed to watch something that's R-rated, or you're not allowed to watch something, you know, a particular, or play a video game with a particular rating. And the problem with that is it's just a rule. It doesn't teach them why. Why not? What's bad about R-rated? Wait a minute, you go see R-rated movies, and why would I not? And so instead, we taught them the principle, garbage in, garbage out. In other words, what are they feeding their mind? And we ask them, whenever you're going to watch something, ask yourself, will this add to my life? Will there be something beneficial out of that? And we gave them that principle. And so even in high school, when we'd say, hey, we don't want you to watch The Simpsons, well, that was actually grade school, but our kids could come and say, you know, here's why I think that's something positive for me. And basically, they understood the principle, so the idea being when they went off to college or after college, they could still apply that principle, am I feeding myself something positive, instead of just a rule, don't go to R-rated movies or go to R-rated movies. And I think that's sort of the key to build up principles, to understand where the rules come from.
You know, you mentioned something earlier that in the material you sent me that overwhelmingly, I think, is the goal. The purpose is to raise kids so that they don't need you. Did I paraphrase that right?
Yeah, that's our first principle. The first principle in the book is your primary role as a parent is to prepare your children for life without you. And I think if you understand that principle, it actually makes parenting a lot easier. Because otherwise we're thinking, okay, I've got to feed them, I've got to clothe them, I've got to clean up after them, I've got to do all these things. When you realize, no, your primary job is to teach them to clothe themselves, to feed themselves, to clean up after themselves. And all of a sudden, how you approach parenting changes. You know, mom, you should be teaching the kids how to do laundry, not doing the laundry for them. That sort of thing. Each parent has to make their own choices what those are. But the point being that if we keep that job in mind, it allows us to make choices of what we're going to do with them or what we're not going to do with them.
You know, one thing you look at is that get into the attitude, there's light at the end of the tunnel when you're in the midst of all these young kids.
Well, the other thing is, these principles, we recommend you tell them to the children. In other words, we've said to our kid, look, I understand we're making you unhappy right now, but my job is to prepare you for life without me, and that means I need to do what's best for you. So we actually tell them straight up, you know, I'm not, you know, that's my role. That's my job.
Okay. Well, let's go into a sort of a hypothetical situation and sort of back to the teenagers and the teenagers that hasn't had this experience of exposure to the 12 principles. What can a parent do if their teen just ignores them? So one of you want to tackle that? If you have a kid that's just grunts, ignores them and does their own thing. I've run into this a few times and the parents have been pulling their hair out.
One of the first questions a parent needs to ask themselves is, why is the child ignoring them in the first place? Have they cut off lines of communication with the child? Have they created an atmosphere of antagonism between the two of them? And once you answer those questions, then that's a good turning point on where to go from there.
Would an apology
maybe an apology is necessary. sometimes a teen will just shut their parents out because they have felt constantly attacked or insulted. They feel like their parents always look for the negative in them. They're always bombarding them with rules and here's how you need to change yourself, rather than just loving them in the overall and working with a particular issue. So that's probably the first question to start with.
Part of it is picking your battles. I think what happens when parents and teenagers get into a negative relationship, it's a cycle, right, that continues. And we saw this with a couple that we were working with, that the dad, it's what I would call don't be the thought police. So the teenager would bite their tongue, and it was clear they were mad about something, and the dad would pounce. And my answer to that is, if they bit their tongue, that's a positive social skill they've learned. Don't be the thought police. Don't jump on them for having the bad attitude if they don't say it. So that helps in one way to calm things down. And then, you know, there has to be lots of positive things, which means you've got to find things to be positive to the teenager about and start to draw them out. And then pick a couple of areas you're going to work on instead of basically them getting the message, you know what, I just don't like you as a person. I don't, you know, I don't like anything that you do.
Okay.
One of the things to keep in mind is that teenage years are really difficult, and there needs to be a place where the child can go and feel like somebody is on my side.
Mm, that's good.
And if they don't get that at home, they're going to go to their friends or some other, they're going to find another way to find a group that loves them unconditionally, that thinks that they're okay just the way they are. So they need to find that love and acceptance from their parents if you want to have a positive relationship there.
Let me ask about chores and a certain age to start chores, and how does that evolve over the life, the child's life up to, you know, age of maturity? That's the chores.
I'm a big proponent on chores, and I think chores can start as early as 2 years old, but it needs to be based on what they can do. So I'm not going to ask my two-year-old to load and unload the dishwasher. However, he can pick up his blocks and put them back in a box. And then as they get older, it can expand based on their abilities. The trouble is, most of the time it's, especially when they're younger, it's so much easier just to do it yourself. But you're not teaching them anything. You're teaching them that if I make a mess, Mom is going to take care of it for me. And that's fine until they have to find someone else.
Yeah, that's a bad lesson for him to get. Because it might be
yeah,
tough right. to get it out of him after later on.
That's where you have to go back to that first principle, that your role is to prepare them for life, which means it takes more time to get them to clean their room where you're standing there helping them do it. Instead of doing it for them. The other thing is, and Lisa and I are both kind of perfectionists, we're business owners, we're entrepreneurs, and so for us, the danger is we see them do the job, it's not right, it's not done perfectly. And one of the things that I think parents have to do, especially parents like us, is you have to set a level of expectation appropriate to the child's age and to the situation. So in our house, for instance, we'd have the children clean the kitchen, but we had two levels of kitchen clean. We had normal, go clean the kitchen, and then we had mommy clean. And so we would say to the kids, go clean the kitchen, and basically, if you'd go in, there'd still be some stuff on the counter. It wouldn't be perfect, and yet they'd still be praised because they cleaned the kitchen. But if we told them, hey, let's say we're having a guest over, we told them we need it to be mommy clean, then they understood there was this higher level of expectation. They were going to wipe down the counters, everything's going to be put away, they were going to do the pots and pans. So I think that part of the key there is not to expect perfection at all times, because we don't expect perfection of ourselves at all times. We decide, okay, I'm going to pick up a little, but nobody's coming over, so it doesn't matter. But then, you know, maybe grandma's coming over, so now we do need to clean deeper. So part of that is when you give them a chore, set the expectations at the right level for their age and ability.
You know, and there's another aspect there, too, and it's maybe the mood of the kid, but I remember as a kid I was asked to pick up the living room or something like that. So I went in and I picked it up and then asked them to see how it was, and they showed all the things that I missed, and I can say that I literally had not seen that stuff. I picked up everything that I saw, but I just didn't see everything, so okay, as a kid. And I think a little bit of sensitivity to the kids is part of what you're saying. You need to be sensitive to where they're at. And I like that. Don't be a perfectionist, because that can be real rough on a kid. That could be a real ego drain.
Right.
Can we bring up another principle that I think is really important?
Sure.
And that is when you go to basically any kind of trying to motivate them or punishment and so forth. And that is, don't ever threaten something you're not willing to do, and don't ever promise something you can't guarantee. And I think this is key at any age. It works really well with teenagers, actually, but at any age. And I'll give you an example. You're driving in the car, and you tell the kid, stop that, or I'm turning the car right around right now. Here's the trick to that. If you ever say that, when they keep doing it, which they will, you have to turn the car around. And how many parents do that? We don't do it. We're driving to the zoo. The kids make it. We say, if you don't stop that, I'm going to turn the car around. But you don't. You go on to the zoo. And they quickly learn you don't really mean that. It only takes one turning around and missing the zoo. And yes, the two kids who were being good lose out also, that they learn that mom means what she says she means. So it's very important that so if you're at Disney World and you say, stop that or I'm going to take you to the hotel, guess what? If they do it, you have to take them to the hotel. So either don't threaten that, or be prepared to follow through. And I think that one thing would revolutionize any teenager home.
Once they get the idea that you're certain. I've seen that in a number of times. A parent gets so exasperated, and kids can drive you hair-pulling, and they get so exasperated, they come out with something, pure emotion, don't mean it, impossible to do, and then they're in a bind, because they can't do what they're doing. So you're expecting, going back to the chat here, what you're suggesting is overbearing parents should chill. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You sort of be, would you want a boss that treated you the way you're treating your child? You think about it at work. Would you want somebody sort of looking over your shoulder saying, you're not doing that right, you know, here, take your lunch now, and so forth. The kids need a certain amount of freedom. You need to give them high expectations and then let them rise to it. But if you're constantly micromanaging them, they're just going to get frustrated, and some then will become sort of nervous people trying to please you, and others will go the other way and say, you're not pleasable, so I don't care anymore.
Okay, I have another comment from here and a question. You were talking about, threatening you're going to turn around if they don't stop, and they don't stop, and you turn around, and the other two kids have to suffer the consequences too. Could that cause a rift in the kids when they get punished for the one that was bad? Have you seen that happens there?
Yes, it will cause a rift, but
it's a good
that's
thing.
A good thing.
Yeah.
That gets peer pressure to work in your favor. but then they also learn the concept of teamwork. You know, you're working as a team, and what if one person fails to hold up their end, then it affects everyone.
I mean, that's true in life, and that's where we're preparing them for life, right? So if you have a business and you're all working one way and one of them does a bad job, it affects the whole company. It affects everybody on the team. And what you'll find is when the kids learn that mom will really turn around, as soon as one starts acting up, the other two will say, stop it, because they don't want to miss out on the zoo. So that's a positive yes, it will cause some friction there, but it can be a very positive force in all of their lives.
Forces them to work as a team, and I think also when you're talking about teamwork, the two parents are working as a team, because that's very important, because kids are pretty good about dividing and conquering.
Mm-hmm. We asked our kids one time what made them feel close to each other, and one of them responded that they had a common enemy, and that was us. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it works. It actually works really well. All the kids can create a camaraderie that it's the parents versus the kids, at least they're all working together for a common cause, whatever that may be. Sometimes it's, you know, they're working together for a common cause, if they want some special trip or some special event or something like that. So they work together to get what they want. It's a good thing.
That reminds me of another a variation on that, talking about why two grandchildren and grandparents bond so readily, and the answer is they have a common enemy.
Right.
Yeah, same thing.
Same thing. How do grandparents fit into this? Did your kids have the benefit of grandparents?
My children had the benefit of long-distance grandparents. So they didn't have a day-to-day relationship with grandparents. I grew up with my grandparents very close in proximity, so they were very involved in my life. My children did not have that. So it made visits to the grandparents, they had to cram it all in a weekend. So
that's a sign of the times.
Grandparents can have a really positive impact because usually what a grandparent brings, you could do it as a parent, but we don't, and that is what a grandparent brings is an unhurried approach to the child. So somebody willing to sit and listen to them and talk to them, and even if you think grandma or grandpa is out of touch, the fact that they're willing to just sit and talk to you and listen to you, that's what develops that bond, and that's part of back to that communication. If as parents we can figure out a way to give our child some of that time, and for us, as our kids were growing up, we would set aside time where I would just take one of my children out, or I would take them on a special trip, or Lisa would just take one of them out. We'd purposely work into our schedule time, individual time spent on the child. In the same way a grandparent might say, hey, I'm going to take your child and go on this trip together. We would do that ourselves. And I think that it shows the kid that they're important, and it also gives them a chance to unhurried time, because as parents, we're always in a hurry, and it's kind of scary that our kids sometimes will even say to us, are we in a hurry again? And I think that's it takes intentionality to break that.
Back on what you commented earlier, I think one of the listeners on the chat was maybe a little bit sensitive. Why does mom have to be the heavy? Was a question.
Mom doesn't have to be the heavy. Dad can be the heavy, or you can take turns. So in our home, we take turns being the bad guy. But there has to be one. There has to be someplace where the line is drawn and you may not cross the line.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that out, Lon. One of the things that's really, really hard is if you can't get mom and dad to agree on a punishment or on a discipline or on what the consequence is, if the kids can go to one and say, hey, mom said I can't go to the party, but can I go? And dad says, sure, go. You've so undercut any chance you have at parenting. And so what we would say is you need to agree. And so what that means for Lisa and I is, let's say that I tell the kid, you know you can't go to this thing. Lisa does not contradict me in front of the child. Instead, she waits until the child's out of the room, and then she tells me, yeah, you're being really stupid. Of course they should get to go, and she explained why. And then she leaves me the opportunity to call the child back in and basically tell them I've changed their mind, they can go. And it goes the other way as well. So if she's disciplining them, we try not to undercut each other in front of the children so that they don't feel like, they can work one of us against the other one.
Yeah, I agree. It's very important and probably easier said than done.
Yes.
Very much.
I think some of it is, and when we do parenting seminars, one of the things we have parents do is write down, each of the parents separately, write down what are the rules of your house and what are the consequences for breaking those rules. And what they'll find is they have very different answers, and it's very important that mom and dad have the same answer or very, very similar answers of what's the consequence for any particular infraction. If your curfew is 10 o'clock and the kid comes back at 10:30, what's the consequence of that? And do mom and dad have the same answer for what that consequence is? And then is that communicated to the child? Are they, do they understand what it is that, what the rules are and what the consequences are? An example we use is if you're speeding, you expect, I'm choosing to speed, I might get pulled over. The worst that's going to happen is you're going to get a speeding ticket. The cop can't decide, well, you know what, I just don't like you, so I'm going to put you in jail for 3 days. Or, there is a understood consequence for that crime. And that should be true for your children. There's an understood consequence for each particular infraction.
Let me get into another area, something that really intrigued me that you put in the written material you sent. What do you mean by teaching kids to be participants in life rather than consumers of life?
Yeah, this is really, I don't know why you nod at me, you're much better at this. This is really important, and that is, I think we have sort of a consumer culture We sit back, we watch television, we watch games, we watch movies, even video games. We sort of we're the spectator, we're the consumer. What are you going to feed me? What are you going to give me? And one of the things Lisa has always said to our kids is the only people that get bored are boring people. And one of the things she's talked about is just how do we make the most of every situation? And we're just sort of very intentional about that. So we talk to each child about how can we make the most of the situation, even if we don't enjoy that. So maybe we're stuck in a line waiting somewhere. How can we enjoy that, come up with something to talk about, or use that time to our benefit? And so for the kids, it's, you know, going out to a meal is the best example, right? So I see it so often that the kids go out to the meal, and they wolf down their food, and then they either play in their Game Boy or they start bugging. They start bugging mom, I want to go, or they ask for permission to go outside, or they wander around the restaurant. What they're being told by allowing to do that is that they're the center of the universe, that everything revolves around them. And instead, if you say, no, you're going to stay and participate in the conversation until mom's done or until dad's done, whoever there always tends to be a slow eater in the family. But don't just let them sit there and stew. They actually should participate in the conversation. That's part of what we mean by that. Participate in life, don't just consume it. And it has to do with whether you treat them as the center of the universe or make them realize that their actions can have a positive or negative impact on others.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then part of that, you know, that boring thing is the participation and being bored. A kid that's bored, there's no good reason for a kid to be bored, a kid with imagination to be bored. That's what I've tried to do with my kids and the grandkids when I've had them, is that if they ever said they're bored, that might be good for a discussion.
That's right.
Yeah.
My brother's children, he took them to Disney World, and at one point his 11-year-old, in standing in the middle of Disney World, his 11-year-old said, I'm bored. And that's, you know, you can't get more entertained than standing in the middle of Disney World. And so
I know. So what was the consequence?
They were sat down on a park bench and they had to sit there for about 30 minutes look around and remember where they were and that their friends were in school at the time. They got to be out of school for this little trip. So
it was just a perspective thing to remind them of sort of where they were and what their privileges were. In that case, it was just a positive thing, just talking to them positively. That if it got really bad attitude-wise, maybe they sit, you know, you think you're bored now, I can make you bored, and don't let them go on rides and so forth. But basically, it's a giving the children a perspective of what the blessings are that they have.
Okay. On the chat there, this says, that makes a suggestion, well, when they say they're bored, take something away that they might be playing with. How do you react to that?
That's one way to do it. The board thing, one story that comes to mind is we went camping a lot when the children were younger. And 9 times out of 10, if we built a campfire, it was going to rain. And it's a good way to be bored, is to sit around a campfire in the rain or being stuck in the tent while the rain's pouring down. But we just use that as an opportunity, you know, make up a game, make up a story, come up with something, tell me what you want to be when you grow up. There's all kinds of opportunities to expand that what potentially is a boring situation and make it into something fun.
Yeah, so it takes imagination
on the parents' part also, but you develop that imagination within your children when you come up with imagination for a potentially less than perfect situation.
It's also, anytime there's sort of downtime like that, you can use that to go back to that communication skill we were talking about, where you can just ask them, hey, did you hear about the things that are happening with these girls in Nigeria? This would be for a teenager. What do you think about that? Does that, you know, do you have any thoughts about it? And the funny thing is you'll find that your 13-year-old has been thinking about something in the news, Al-Qaeda or something, that you would think, what? I didn't even notice they were paying attention. And so sometimes, you know, something that's either happened in the family or that's happened in your community, you can actually, in that sort of bored moment, you can actually ask them a question. What do you think about this that's happening? And you'll be surprised the depth of thought that's happening inside your child.
Yeah, they come time to really surprise you. And I've had experience with teenagers one time way back when I was in the JC's, the Junior Chamber of Commerce, was running a haunted house. And the kids that were most active, most responsible, were the sort of flounders and losers in school. But I gave them something, or we gave them something to do, some responsibility, and they really gravitated. I made a big thing, understanding of teenagers in that experience, that even the kids that are floundering, if you approach them right, they'll really jump in on the life. Let's go to another question. You compare in your material technology use to nutrition. So could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that, and the principle we give is technology is like nutrition. Children need to be taught what's healthy and what is not. Technology is a good thing, right? I mean, how amazing is it that I have a device in my pocket that sort of has the sum of all human knowledge? You know, you can look up anything, and we enjoy that with our kids. Sometimes we'll look up topics and so forth, but it also can be overwhelming, especially a kid that sort of lives on video games and maybe they disappear into their room forever. Technology can be positive and negative, and so what we teach the children, and we just tell them straight up, you know, this is like what you eat. You know, if you chocolate bars are great, and we love chocolate bars, but if you ate chocolate bars 10 hours a day or for every meal, you're going to be very unhealthy. And it's the same way with technology. So video games can be a lot of fun. We have that same conversation about, you know, what you feed yourself. But from a nutrition standpoint, how much are you feeding and what kinds of things are you feeding yourself? So, you know, are they playing violent games all the time? Well, we have a conversation with them. What are you feeding yourself? How is this positive? And how much are you feeding yourself of that? So in that sense, as parents, we need to look at it like nutrition, that we need to guide them in the same way we would guide them in food. I think a lot of times parents just sort of leave video games and technology, they just sort of leave it alone. They don't really look at it. They don't notice that their children are playing mature video games. And there's a lot of things we can do there by just applying that same principle of, would you do that with their food if they were just eating anything they wanted?
Well, I've been convinced that the internet or video games an addiction, that it's a bona fide addiction, because I've seen some kids to where that's all they can think about. If it's not a video game, then their effect gets flat and they're not interested. Too much wrapped up into it. Were your kids a little too old, or have you ridden the problem of a kid trying to get the kids away from their games? Because that's been difficult for most parents. Have how do you get to keep the kids get them away from the games? So
advice
that you can give.
We did that with our youngest son. We noticed he was spending too much time on video games, and so I actually went to him at one semester of high school. And I challenged him. I said, you know what, Michael, I don't think this is a positive effect in your life. Here's what I'd like to do. I would like you to voluntarily give up video games for the semester. And just at the end of the semester, see, are your grades better? Are you happier? Are you healthier? You know, just do a self-assessment. Does this make your life better? And being our child, he came back and sort of negotiated. He said, well, all right, he would do that. But he wanted two things. He wanted us to set aside Sunday night as a game night for the families, because he liked to play games and we were always busy. And he wanted to sit in my chair. I had a leather chair that none of the kids were allowed to sit in. So we kind of laughed at that, but we made this deal with him. He gave up video games for a semester, and then he got a couple of extra privileges instead. And then about, I don't know, 2 months into the semester, something like that, we just asked him, okay, so no video games. How's it going? Are you happier? Is life different? Is life better? And he begrudgingly admitted that life was better. And so then, you know, we left him in charge of it. These were recommendations for him. And he, after that semester, he I think he went the next semester without video games, but then he gradually over the summer started adding them back in. And the idea was, like nutrition, it's sort of like taking a fast from gluten or something, you know, where you sort of show your body, oh, you know what, I don't need that much gluten. It sort of showed him that not overwhelming himself with video games was better for his life. And then he reintroduced them to his life himself. So I think it's very important to fight that addiction to video games. And there's a variety of ways to do it. That's one way we did it with our youngest son.
You know, let's go back to, you talked about the kids, your son talked about, I think it was your son, talked about the girls in Nigeria or in Al-Qaeda and some of those, and you didn't even know they were listening. I know there's some people feel like that kids don't need to be involved with the grown-up stuff. They need to be kids. So what's your thinking on that? I guess it comes down to, are you protect the kids or prepare them? That's been a debate for years.
Well, so we don't think it's a debate. Go back to our principle number one. Your primary role as a parent is to prepare your children for life without you. And for us, we think the big danger is you protect your kids, they turn 18, boom, now they face everything all at once. We would much rather they face the hard things when we're there to protect them, when we're there to catch them, when we're there to guide their thinking about those issues, rather than have it just sort of all overwhelm them all at once at 18 or 21 or whatever that age is where they all of a sudden lose your protection. So to us, that your primary role is to prepare them for life. That means no subject is off limits. I know I'm not saying you take your 8-year-old and start talking about 9/11. You don't want to, you don't want to make them nervous about life. But certainly we think that you should deal with issues from a conversation standpoint while they're still under your influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you said earlier, what age appropriate? You don't want to overwhelm an 8-year-old with all the implications and dangers and everything else. One more question, and then I want to give you a chance to talk about your book and your seminars, how people can get a hold of you. But what dating advice did you or should you or give to your teens?
Well, that's an interesting question. And a lot of times when dating came up in our house, we responded with a question, why do you want to date? And so we told them, with these children, when they were interested in dating, we sat down with them, we asked them questions, and we told them at the time, there is no right or wrong answer. We just want you to think about these things and go in intellectually into a relationship. Why do you want to date? What's the purpose of dating? What are you hoping to accomplish by this relationship? And that, by asking them those questions, they had to consider what was the point. And sometimes the answer was, well, everybody else's school is doing it and I feel a little awkward going out and I don't have a date. Okay, that's a legitimate response, but go in knowing that you don't really have any relationship expectations. It's more of a companionship that you're looking for, and that's all right.
One of the things I think Lisa has done particularly well is what she's talking about right now. It's harder for me because I'm a little more judgmental, I think, but she would get the kids to talk about anything with the idea being there no right or wrong. The older they get, they got to make these choices. We're preparing them for life. So, for instance, when your teenager starts dating, we would actually have a conversation. If they get serious with, let's say one of our boys got serious with a girl, we'd sit down with both of them, the boy and the girl, and ask them, what are your standards? What are your boundaries? What will you do with each other? Have you set what those boundaries are? Is it kissing? Is it holding hands? Is it petting? What is it? And that's a really uncomfortable conversation for most of us to have. You know, some of the parents right now are putting their hands over their ears. But the idea is not to pounce on them when they say something that you don't agree with. It's to get it out on the open so that the two of them agree on what their boundaries are. And because one of the things we always told our teenagers is, if you don't set boundaries in the light of day, you're not going to keep them in the heat of the moment in the dark. So, and then we taught them things like, if you're not married to this person, don't sit on the sofa underneath the same blanket. We'd say to our son, if you don't end up marrying her, you're holding hands with, you're sitting under a blanket with somebody else's wife. So those kinds of conversations. But basically, again, no topic is off limits. And our kids learned that with us, that there's no question we won't ask them or their date.
So be transparent and honest.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But and not judgmental.
I had three daughters, and so how I saw it, how I told them was, when they were in grade school, sixth grade, starting to think about it, they says, okay, at least through junior high, if you want a date, the boy has to ask me. And My oldest daughter got around, tried to get around it a couple times, and then she just threw up her hands and said it wasn't worth it, and so she didn't date until she was in high school. I think I saved myself some problems.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because they would have, and I think just like you're talking about, it would have forced them to do something that be honest, be open, what they're really going on. Well, we just have about 1 or 2 minutes left, and would you tell the listeners, I really appreciated this. This is good. A lot of good information, but how people can get a hold of you if they're interested in a seminar, if they want to order your book, or even just talk to you.
Yeah, well, buildingbetterhumans.com is our website. They could go there. They can email us. We will personally respond. They can get the book or ebook through there or through Amazon. And they can also contact us about seminars through that website as well. And we're happy to just answer emails. We're not psychiatrists or psychologists. We're just parents that have gone before you. We've made a study of this, so we've read just about all the parenting books on the market. We've gone to lots of seminars, and we've been applying this in other people's lives and our own for 20 years. But in the same way we advocate this open, honest communication with our children, we will give you open and honest answers if you have questions for us in discussion. We don't have the answers to everything, but we're happy to add to the dialogue as you're figuring out how to be great parents.
Okay, well, we've run out of time. This has been great. And we've been talking to David and Lisa DeVoe on Building Better Humans.
Thank you.